Here's the editor of Lenswork Publishing, Brooks Jensen.
Hello, everybody. This is Brooks Jensen. And before I begin today's podcast topic, let me plant a seed for what's coming next week. On Monday, don't know when you'll be listening to this, I figure I better specify the date. On July 8th, Monday, we'll be formally announcing this year's Lenswork Community Book Project. As I suspect many of you know, the first of these Lenswork Community Book Projects was published in 2016 and featured Seeing in Sixes projects. That was such an interesting and exciting idea. We did four of those books in 4 years in a row. Including those four, we've now done a total of 8 community book projects that consisted of single images like Our Magnificent Planet and last year's Light, Glorious Light. And in 2022, we published trilogies that consisted of 3 image projects. Well, this year's project, which we'll be announcing on the 8th, we are opening the floodgates. Legacy 2024 will be the title of this year's book, and our intention is to include your very best work, your legacy work, the work you want to be known for, the work you're most proud of. And we know that different people have different kinds of work that will fit that category. So this year, we're going to include single images, we'll include trilogies, and we'll include 6 image projects, your choice, with no restriction on subject matter. So we're not looking for a certain genre of work. We're looking for your best work. We want to see your life's best work, regardless of the subject, of the format, of the treatment, with or without text. It's all about your best work, your legacy. That's the sole focus of this year's Lenswork Community Book Project. And for the first time ever, we'll be simultaneously publishing a printed book, like we've done in the past, and an expanded digital version that'll have more images, more photographers, and more excellent photography. The obvious advantage of the digital version is we're not locked into a page count, so we can include more work. We're very excited about that. So, look for our formal announcement next Monday, July 8th, 2024, for specifics and entry instructions. And now, let's jump into the podcast for today. From its earliest days, photography has always been bifurcated into two aspects of producing a photograph: what we do with the camera in the field, and then what we do to process that image in the darkroom, or now in the digital darkroom. It's always been that way, probably always will be that way. The exception might be Polaroids, and I'm sure there's probably others you could think of, but for the vast majority of photographs, there's this bifurcation between field work and darkroom work. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately because of the incredible advances that have been made in processing. And my temptation, I should confess, is to fall into that trap where I'll just fire away in the field with the thought in the back of my brain that I can always fix it in Photoshop. I can fix it in Lightroom. I can fix it with some sort of fancy post-processing. And the truth is, that's not always the case. That there is an important component of making a photograph that can only happen in the field. In my youth, that was primarily this business about pre-visualization. We had to compensate how we exposed and processed the film in order to make up for problems in contrast and shadow detail and all that kind of stuff. And so a lot of what happened in the field to make decisions was not just where to stand and place the tripod, not just composition, but it also included this exposure and processing component. And to be honest, in my youth, when I was so focused on trying to get that right, thinking that the real magic of photography that I was struggling to get had to do with beautiful tones and grain-free mid-tones, smooth skies, all that stuff, the technical aspects of photography, that I probably didn't spend as much time on other aspects of field work that I should have. I had been taught in school days to disregard the rule of thirds as being a rule that leads to predictable images. Well, with that planted in my mind, it was easy to forget about the subtleties of composition, or even depth of field was something I didn't spend much time working on because I always wanted infinite depth of field in my landscape work, for example. So the emphasis in, maybe the first 30 years of my photography was all about getting the exposure and development right, a fundamental composition, and that's about as far as I went. And this has led to a bad habit that's so easy to fall into, and that is the habit of making straight photographs. But there are ever so many creative options that can only be accomplished in the field if we think beyond the straight photograph. And I've developed this list of creative options that I've affixed to my camera to help remind me of them when I'm out in the field. I've developed a new habit of scanning this list so that I can remember that there are certain things that can only be done in the field. In my youth, I probably spent 20% of my time, 20%, I don't know, maybe 30% at most of my time and effort thinking about composition and emotion and light and all of that, and 70% of my time thinking about processing steps and getting the right exposure and all that kind of stuff. Now that's probably reversed. I spend a lot more of my creative life in the field thinking through the creative options that we have that I never used to spend time thinking about. And that's what I wanted to focus on today, was some of those creative options. Because this is not a habit with me, I've actually printed these out on little labels that I have stuck on my camera that work as mnemonic aids when I'm out in the field. I can scan down this list real quickly and see if there's anything in there that I could do in the field today that I can't do when I get back home and I'm working in Lightroom or Photoshop. So here they are. Believe it or not, there are 16 separate things that I've identified. There's probably more than that, but these are the ones I have on my camera. 16 things that are my reminders of what I can only do in the field. These are my field options. Number one is I can make a panorama image. I know I can crop to a panorama aspect ratio, but that's not what I'm getting at. I'm talking about a multiple exposure where you scan and make several overlapping exposures from left to right or right to left with the purpose of assembling those images later. Panorama images are all kinds of fun, and I love composing that way, particularly in the landscape. And it's always better to create a panorama image with multiple exposures that will eventually be stitched together into one than it is to try to simply crop into a panorama aspect ratio later. The second option is what I call jigsaw images. This is where you're, again, making multiple exposures, but unlike a panorama that's all in a straight row, these might be offset vertically above and below and maybe even sometimes tilted a little bit to the left and to the right. And you put these all together in an image that has an irregular border around it. I call them jigsaw images. I've seen them also called joiners. That's something you can only do in the field. I suppose theoretically you could do something like this in Photoshop, but it's so much easier just to do it in the field and then stitch the images together in Photoshop later to make one of these really expansive, interesting, irregular border images. The third is HDR. Lots and lots of you I know are doing HDR. I don't use it as much as a lot of photographers I know because I find I can pull enough out of the shadows on almost every photograph that I make that I very rarely need to do HDR. But there are times in which the contrast ratio of the scene is so great that the only way to make a successful image is to make an exposure for the highlights and an exposure for the shadows, maybe even an exposure for the midtones, and then combine them in HDR in Photoshop. And if you don't make those two or three exposures that allow you to create an HDR, you'll have very limited capabilities once you get back into Photoshop. But if you go ahead and make those exposures in the field, it becomes an easy thing to do. Number four is focus stacking. I grew up with view cameras. We used tilts and swings and all that kind of stuff to ensure that we had an extremely large depth of field so that we could get everything in focus. Well, we don't have tilts and swings in today's digital cameras, at least I don't. Although I do think there are a couple of brands that have a tilt and swing lens, but they're very expensive and cumbersome to work with, so it's so much easier just to do focus stacking. But if you don't make the multiple exposures in the field with various focal distances, then you don't have the ability to do a focus stack when you get back home. So anytime I'm thinking in terms of large depth of field, I just automatically create a group of focus stack images so that I can create that large depth of field image if I need to back once I get home. Number five is vertical and horizontal compositions. Particularly if you're a project-oriented photographer, you may not know in the field, when you're thinking about your project, you may not know if you're going to need vertical compositions or horizontal compositions at the time you assemble the multiple images into a project, into a little book or chapbook or PDF or whatever. And so I try to make it a habit when I have an interesting subject to make a vertical composition and a horizontal composition as two separate exposures so that I have either one when I need it back in preparing the book or the PDF or whatever. Number six, pixel shift high-res capture. My camera is a 20-megapixel camera. Sometimes I know I'm going to need more than that, particularly if I'm going to make a very large image or if I know I'm going to do some cropping. Well, my camera has this pixel shift technology where it will take a series of 8 pictures, I think it is, overlapping a half a pixel in each direction, and then assembling that into a composite high-res image that is either 40 megapixels or 80 megapixels. I can do some of that back in Photoshop and Lightroom with enhanced resolution, but I find, after having done quite a number of tests, that I'm better off to do that in the field with the camera creating the optical variations rather than relying strictly on software interpolation. So if I know I'm going to need a high-resolution image that's greater than my camera natively captures, I can flip over into this pixel shift high-res mode and get what I need. Number seven, there are two actions that I do back in Lightroom or Photoshop that can affect the ultimate cropping of the image. One of them is just cropping, and I always want to make sure that I've got enough room around the edges of the photograph that if I need to crop a little bit to get rid of some little edge pokey or some such thing, that I have enough around my main subject to be able to do that. So I always do a composition that's tightly composed with the exact focal length, the zoom exactly where I want it to be, and then I'll just back off a few millimeters into focus and make a second exposure if I know I have something on the edge that I have to really be careful to take care of. Even worse is when I do a transformation in Lightroom, for example, where I want to rectify verticals or make sure that I get rid of any barrel distortion or whatever. Sometimes that can cause the image to be cropped rather substantially. And when I think I'm going to need to do a transform like that, the best thing I can do is to zoom out so that I get much larger picture than I want, then do the transform back in Lightroom, which will crop out a bunch of stuff, but that's okay because I photograph with the intention of having those things cropped out if I wanted them to. And that zooming out so that I have that breathing room for images that are going to be transformed for verticals and horizontals. I know I'll have enough information after having zoomed out that I can do so without losing some important parts of the composition. Number eight is ICM, in-camera movement blur. I don't do a lot of this, but I know for some people it's a very important technique and one that is really handled best in the camera, not handled with software. Maybe there's applications and whatnot that can create ICM appearance out of an image that wasn't photographed with ICM, but of the images I've seen, the ones that do ICM in the camera seem to be better, more believable anyway. Number nine, multiple layered exposures. This is where you make an exposure and then you make another exposure on top of that exposure so that you're blending layers. And you can do this 4, 5, 6 layers, etc. Different cameras are different. But when I need to do that technique, I find it best to do it in the field rather than doing it back in Photoshop, because if it doesn't work in Photoshop, I don't have any recovery for that. But if I do it in the field and I realize, nah, it just doesn't look very good, I can just try it again and try it again. And so multiple layered exposures are something I prefer to do in the field rather than with fancy blending in Photoshop. Number 10, aspect ratio compositions. My camera's native aspect ratio is 4:3. Lots and lots of cameras are 3:2. But the point is, that's just the aspect ratio of the camera. Of course, we can make a picture be any aspect ratio we want. Sometimes I want a square. Sometimes I want something that's not quite 4:3. Sometimes I want it even longer than 3:2. Those aspect ratio compositions, I find, are better to do in the field than cropping when I get back into Photoshop. You can do it both ways. But if I'm thinking in terms of the aspect ratio that I want, and say, for example, I want a square picture, I can set up in my camera lines that show me a square picture in the viewfinder, and I seem to be able to compose more accurately when I can see it rather than when I crop to it later. Maybe that's just me, but it's an important aspect of what I like to do in the field rather than back in software. Number 11, burst mode sequences. This is, again, something you have to do in the field. If there's a photograph or a composition that needs a burst mode sequence, you can't do that if you've just made one picture, just a straight photograph out in the field. Burst mode sequences are a decision you have to make with the camera in your hand and the subject that you want to photograph. Number 12, selective color compositions. This is where I combine a black and white portion of the image with a color portion of the image. Lots and lots of times I can do that back in Photoshop or Lightroom, and there's no penalty for not having thought it through out in the field. But every once in a while I've been caught with something not quite working right that I realize maybe a slightly different composition might have been a better choice. But I don't know that until I'm working in selective color back in Lightroom or Photoshop, and by then it's too late. So when I know I'm going to do a selective color composition, and there are some areas in the photograph that are going to be black and white and some areas that are going to be in color, I'm much better off to know that beforehand so that I can compose accordingly. It's not a make or break, but it's often advantageous to do it in the field. Number 13, reverse angle shots. For project-oriented photography, where you're going to do a group of images to tell a little story, very often a reverse angle shot is going to be an important component of that story. But that's something you can only do in the field. And so I love having this one on my little cheat sheet that's attached to my camera so that I can remember, oh yeah, don't forget to make some reverse angle shots just in case you need them. If I don't need them, I haven't wasted much time. But if I need them, and very often I do, it's really terrific to have several reverse angle shots to choose from. Number 14, long shutter movement. Think of Michael Kenna and Flowing Water. This is something that I suppose you could technically do in Photoshop. I've tried it with a number of burst exposures, and then you build them up into a giant layer, and the water ends up looking like it's moving. I've just never been as successful doing that in software as compared to doing it in the field, stacking on some neutral density filters and polarizers and whatever, and getting a long, long exposure in the field. That always feels much more natural and much more visually pleasing than trying to do something in Photoshop or Lightroom. Maybe I just don't know the right techniques, but long shutter movement is something I keep looking for when I'm in the field, and when I think that I want it, that's a really important one to get with the camera in hand. Number 15 is polarized light. I used to use polarizers all the time on my cameras because it was one of the primary tools for controlling local lightness and darkness. But I use it less now than I used to because now I have the color mixer, and a lot of times I can create the contrast I want with that. However, there are times when the only way to create the tones that you want is to use polarized light, and using a polarizer on the lens is just about the only solution. I easily forget about this one. I guess maybe because I carry the polarizer in my pack, but it's hardly ever on my camera, and so it's easy for me to forget that it's an option, and that's why I have it on the list that's affixed to my camera, so when I scan down this, I go, oh yeah, is this something I could improve with the polarizer? And if so, it's easy to slap it on and go. At least I haven't forgotten it. And number 16 is a memory aid for me. Many, many times when I'm out in the field, I'll have some thought about what it is that I'm seeing, the subject, how I'm photographing it, why I'm making certain decisions. And if I don't write those things down, then I'll forget about them. And it's so easy with the camera in your hand to not write them down. And I can't tell you how many times I've come back from a field session and thought, now wait a minute, where was that again? And what was the name of that town? And how do you spell it? And what was I feeling? And why did I make this picture? Making notes about my response in the field is something I can almost always only do when I'm in the field. And so that's number 16 on my list of memory aids for field options when I'm out there photographing. Those are the 16 things that I have as a cheat sheet affixed to my camera so that I can scan down it at any given time that are things I can only do in the field. Real quickly again, panorama images, jigsaw images, HDR, focus stacking, vertical and horizontal compositions, pixel shift, high-res captures, crop and transform preparations by zooming out a little bit, ICM or camera movement blur, multiple layered exposures, aspect ratio compositions, burst mode sequences, selective color compositions, reverse angle shots, long shutter movement, polarized light, and notes. Notice what's missing from this list. Nothing about exposure, nothing about development, the old zone system pre-visualization days don't even enter my thought process now. But these 16 things that are the important field options for me now are the ones that I really spend my time thinking about when I'm out in the world with my camera.
Copyright 2024, Lenswork Publishing.